Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Jack Siegel. I am a retired U.S. diplomat currently serving with my wife Karen as co-chairs of the International Affairs Forum of Traverse City, and I'm also an adjunct professor of political science at NMC. I will be your moderator for the evening. I'd like to welcome you to this forum, sponsored by the League of Women Voters Grand Traverse Area and co-sponsored by the League of Women Voters Leelanau County, Interlochen Public Radio, and the Up North Media Center. The League of Women Voters is a nonpartisan political organization.
Sounds like a cell phone.
I was going to say it later, but if you would kindly turn off your cell phones. Okay, so everybody's got one. Just, you know, hit that thing that says off. Okay. Thank you. All right, we'll start that paragraph again. The League of Women Voters is a nonpartisan political organization that encourages the informed and active participation of citizens in their government. The League does not endorse candidates or parties, but it does seek to increase understanding of major policy issues and to inform voters of the positions of candidates and parties through information and forums such as this one. If you're interested in learning more about the League, information will be available in the hall on your way out tonight. The House of Representatives is one of two chambers of the U.S. Congress that constitute our government's legislative branch. There are 435 voting representatives in the House, proportionally representing the population of the 50 states. Michigan has 14 members, each representing approximately 710,000 individuals. Members of the House introduce bills and resolutions, offer amendments, and serve on committees. The constitutional requirement that they stand for election every 2 years is designed to ensure that House members are responsive to the will of the people and that the House of Representatives itself serves as a forum for the political priorities of the population. To learn more about the institution, go to www.house.gov. We are delighted to have here tonight three candidates for the position of Member of the House of Representatives of the United States Congress, representing the 1st Congressional District of Michigan. They are, in alphabetical order, identified in accordance with their preferences, Dr. Dan Benishek, Republican Party, Mr. Ellis Bowl, Green Party, and General Jerry Cannon, Democratic Party. In order to make sure that each of our candidates has a chance to be heard, we ask that the audience maintain silence and hold their applause until the end of the forum. If you have a question for the candidates, please write it on the card provided and give it to an usher. Questions will be collected and reviewed by screeners who look for relevance, propriety, clarity, and legibility. We will not have time to ask all of your questions, but we do collect them and send copies to all the candidates. The candidates may also be available after the forum to answer your questions. The forum will last 90 minutes and is being recorded for later viewing and listening by the public access channel Up North TV, channel 189, and by Interlochen Public Radio. By agreement among the candidates, only credentialed members of the media who have identified themselves to the League will be recording this event. The audience will refrain from making any electronic recording of the forum. I'd like to remind the audience now to turn off your cell phones if you didn't catch that first reminder. You will be able to take pictures at the end of the forum. Now the format of the event. We will have two-minute opening statements by each candidate responding to the question, why I am running for this office. These will be followed by questions from the audience provided on the cards as I've described. Each candidate will have up to 90 seconds to respond to questions. An optional 30-second rebuttal will be allowed to a candidate whose name is mentioned in a response. A League representative will keep time and alert the candidate after 1 minute and at the end of the 90 seconds, whereupon the candidate may only complete a sentence before I will be forced to interrupt. I will not ask follow-up questions myself unless such questions have already been submitted from the audience and provided to me by the League. The candidates will respond to each question in alphabetical order, and as we go through the questions, each candidate will have the opportunity to respond first. We will end the forum with two-minute closing statements by each candidate, beginning this time in reverse alphabetical order. Unless there are questions from the candidates about the format, we will begin with the opening statements. Dr. Benishek, please.
Thank you, Jack. I'd like to thank the League of Women Voters for hosting tonight's event, and also thank my opponents, General Cannon and Mr. Bowl, for their participation. I'd also like to thank my wife, Judy, who's here tonight and who's been with me every step of this journey. I appreciate the opportunity and look forward to the discussion. You know, as a doctor who ran my own practice and treated patients for 30 years in Northern Michigan and a lifelong resident of Northern Michigan, I couldn't sit back and watch our government put trillions of dollars of debt onto our future generations. I'm running for Congress because I want to continue to work toward ensuring that our children and grandchildren have the opportunity to earn the American dream like we did growing up. My focus is working to strengthen the economy, increase job creation, increase job training, develop an affordable, patient-centered healthcare system, and meet our commitment to our veterans. I'm a doctor, and in the operating room, we worked together and didn't argue. We worked for the benefit of the patient. Bureaucrats and politicians in Washington don't act the same way. They're pushing for more red tape, more spending, and more government control over families, small businesses, and our way of life. Instead of more government, we need to concentrate on initiatives that will cut the red tape, empower families and businesses, and get things under control. Increasing opportunities for vocational education, ensuring veterans get the benefits they have earned, reforming our healthcare system so that it works for families and seniors, and getting spending under control will always be top priorities. We have a lot of work yet to do to turn things around in Northern Michigan and in this country, but I'm committed to doing it. I think you'll agree that the opportunity for the American dream for future generations is worth the fight.
Thank you. Mr. Bowl.
Thank you, Jack. Hello, I'm Ellis Bowl. I'm with the Green Party. I live in Charlevoix. I, too, want to thank the League for having this debate, and particularly for inviting me into it. That hasn't always happened with the Green Party in the past. I'm not here, but in other forums. At any rate, climate change is the defining issue of our times. We need a climate activist in Congress. I hope we will have several questions about climate tonight. About me, I'm an attorney. I practiced labor law from the labor side for 25 years in Detroit. I moved to Charlevoix 14 years ago to be with my family, which has been there for over 100 years. I practice part-time now, mostly in environmental law. I'm also a runner, cross-country skier with 76,000 lifetime miles, and I sing in a men's choir. My legal cases have set major precedents for workers in the federal courts. When you go home tonight, please visit the biography page of my website, ellisbowl.org. Also on the site are discussions of a variety of issues, which we'll cover tonight, from ISIS to Social Security to global warming to torture to militarization of the police to Israel to single-payer health care and Ebola and more. Last year, I got an 8-month injunction against 13 huge horizontal frack wells in Kalkaska County, three of which would have been the biggest in the United States in terms of water usage. I also have a pipeline case in the Court of Appeals. I'm also working on a ballot initiative regarding that. My cases have raised state issues, but federal law can be brought to bear because climate affects everyone. Another important issue is human rights. Congress enacted a criminal statute on torture and conspiracy to commit it in 1994 and have reenacted it twice. Torture will come before Congress again. A witnessed and, to date, unrefuted event at Guantanamo Bay happened in 2004. I hope we'll have a question about that. I look forward to tonight's discussion.
Thank you. General Cannon.
Well, I, too, would like to thank the League for hosting this evening. It's a great turnout. What I'd like to talk about is I was raised by my Irish immigrant grandmother, who instilled in me a great sense of responsibility and purpose and discipline. And I remember a couple of things that she left with me that have always stuck is know who you are, know where you're from, and don't be part of the problem. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a problem. Washington is broken. The 113th Congress is the most do-nothing Congress since Harry Truman was president. Like many others, I'm frustrated with politicians who are unwilling to compromise in the best interests of those who elected them. My entire professional life has been that of a public servant. People have counted on me to step up, to get involved, to serve and protect our way of life in northern Michigan. I've done this willingly because I'm a public. To me, public service is a calling. It's a vocation. It's about making life better for those that you serve. I'm ready to answer that call again, to set my personal life aside, to roll up my sleeves and go to work. Not just go to a place and call it work, but to do the hard things that need to be done and make things happen, like protecting our environment, protecting public education, protecting our economy, and to fight for equality and opportunity, to ensure that Social Security and Medicare are kept for the peace of mind and the dignity of our senior citizens, to make sure that our veterans get the same level of service as the 48 states above Michigan. From private to general, and from patrolman to sheriff, I know how to bring people together and to get things done. There are no quick fixes. Steady is the win of the, will win the day. But I know how to bring action and results, bring people together to find common ground and to solve problems. They know, the people know that elect us, that working from the middle is where we make the progress. We take an oath, we make a promise, we have an obligation to represent all of the people. Our actions should reflect our words. As a general, I took care of my troops. As a sheriff, I took care of my county. And as your congressman, I promise to take care of all of the people of Michigan's 1st Congressional District.
Thank you.
I'm Jerry Cannon, and I would be proud to represent you as your congressman. Thank you.
Thank you very much. For the first question from the audience deals with taxes. I will read the question. Representative Dave Camp of Michigan introduced a comprehensive tax reform bill this year. It was not adopted. What would a comprehensive tax reform bill include if you proposed one? And we begin with Mr. Bowl.
There are three points I would refer to in answer to that question. All of which are on the Social Security page of my website. Cap on FICA taxes, 6.2% FICA tax, should be eliminated. It's a regressive tax. It allows the wealthy people who make over 100, I believe the figure is 117,000 or thereabouts, there's no tax on that portion of their income. And so that should be eliminated and will change FICA from being a regressive tax. Secondly, a financial transactions tax. When you go to the store to buy bubble gum or buy soap or buy food or buy other products, I guess not food, but to buy other products, you have to pay a sales tax. But there should also be a tax on financial transactions. When somebody buys a share of stock, there should be a tax on that. That would tax the wealthy again. Finally, eliminate the preferential rate at which long-term capital gains are taxed compared to ordinary income.
Thank you. General Cannon.
Well, taxes is obviously a big issue. I think our tax system needs to be reformed. I would like to see the corporate tax lowered to about 25%. I'd like to see some safeguards put in to prevent our corporations from doing what we call, we read about lately, called inversion, where they're taking their business overseas. We need to stop that. I think the tax advantages for taking jobs outside of the country, that needs to be ended. I think we need to find a way to make sure that there is equity in our tax system. And so there's a lot of different ideas about how to do that. Representative Camp spent the better part of the last 3 to 4 years working on that. There's obviously some good ideas in there, but there's also a room for a lot of discussion. And so at the end of the day, it's all about finding fairness and equity to make sure that we maintain a standard of living in this country that affords people the opportunity to enjoy the American dream. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Dr. Benishek.
Thanks. That's a good question. You know, Dave Camp is from Michigan. He worked really hard on this tax reform bill. And frankly, what we need is a fairer, simpler tax code. I mean, it's so darn complicated. I mean, a lot of people have to hire somebody just to figure it out. You know, basically, Dave's idea was to simplify the whole thing and bring down rates. One of our biggest problems in this country, frankly, is that we're spending too much money, and that we need to get the spending under control so we're not taxed so much either, and we're not saddling our children with debt. You know, that's the reason I'm here, in limiting waste in the government, making sure that the government spends its money wisely and focuses on the things that government is supposed to do, the things we need to focus on to get the spending down so that we don't have to be taxed so much and so complicated. Thanks.
Thank you. Our next question deals with the environment, and I'm compiling several questions. Climate change has been called the greatest challenge to this generation, and the questions relate to that issue. Would you support a revenue-neutral carbon tax to address climate change, and what policies would you support to deal with this issue? And if it fits into your answer, the question of the pipeline in the Straits of Mackinac, is this an issue that the federal or the state government should deal with? And the first responder in this case will be General Cannon.
Well, global warming or climate change, whatever you choose to call it, is a serious issue. I believe that there is a cause and an effect. We can argue all day long about why that happened, why it's happening. But what we really need to talk about is what needs to be done. And so I would support a carbon neutral program to sort of get after that in a sense. You know, the earth is warming. The ice is melting. The water is rising. We got to decide what it is we want to do to make sure that we're protecting those cities that are in low-lying areas. You look at the hurricane a couple of years ago that hit New York and New Jersey, obviously devastating. This is just going to continue. I think the other part of the question was on
the pipeline the Straits of Mackinac.
Well, listen, that pipeline runs, I mean, under the Straits of Mackinac, absolutely unacceptable. If we tried to do that today, it would not be allowed. That pipeline also runs all the way to Manistique. And so we got great exposure, not only under the straits, but along that whole shoreline of the Upper Peninsula. And so we need to be prepared. Our Coast Guard is not prepared. And so I say if we don't need the pipeline, we've got others going down through Ontario and Wisconsin, let's take it out. If we got to have it, then replace it. There can be no room for any margin of error, no room whatsoever. So if we replace it, let's put one in place that was built to the standards of today.
Thank you very much. Dr. Benishek.
Thank you. You know, as a doctor, I know that you don't change an operation before you're sure of the science. And frankly, I don't believe that the science of climate change is well-founded. We need to be sure that we don't make major changes in policy before we understand the science. You know, the folks in this administration are instituting policies related to climate change that are going to dramatically increase energy prices. Right now in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, they're faced with a major increase in their energy prices due to policies of the administration related to climate change, in the face of one of the coldest winters that we've ever had. And first time in my memory, the pipes are frozen in the city of Ishpeming, their main water pipes. So we need to be sure that the science is sound, and we need to be sure that before we institute changes that will increase everyone's energy prices, seniors in northern Michigan, people living on fixed incomes, nursing homes. I mean, I talked to a nursing home administrator just last week who told me that their bill is going to go up $68,000 while their reimbursement from Medicare is going down. It's going to be very tough for these people to keep their businesses open, keep their nursing home open, you know, if we have massive energy increases.
Thank you. Mr. Bowl.
Thanks, Jack. I have so much to say on this that I cannot do it in 90 seconds, so I hope we get more questions on climate change. First of all, as the United Nations said last spring, three-quarters of the fossil fuel reserves need to stay in the ground. These are the reserves that we know about, not to mention what we don't know about. Dan Benishek says climate change is baloney. Jerry Cannon says it's a real thing, and I appreciate that, but he also says on his website that oil and natural gas, American, needs to be increased, albeit responsibly. I don't believe it can be increased responsibly. All the science points the other way, including a recent article in Nature. What would I do about climate change? Reduce energy demand by over half. Meet the remaining demand with wind, solar, and energy storage. Shift fossil fuels subsidies, including military, to clean solution. Institute zero waste laws and encourage climate-friendly, sustainable agriculture. Cap and trade, I don't agree with. It's a trading scheme, but there's another mechanism called fee and dividend, which I'll respond to if we get another question, which is revenue neutral. And so I recommend that for bringing down the issue of demand.
Thank you. Our next question has to do with health care and Medicare, and I'm combining several questions. One writer says, it's not too hard to remember all the problems associated with the Affordable Care Act prior to the implementation of the act. If not the Affordable Care Act, then what do you recommend? And related to that, a veteran writes, for nearly 50 years, I have paid nearly $160,000 into Social Security and Medicare. I will be paying another $105 a month towards Medicare. How will you protect my coverage and keep it affordable? So we are dealing with the Affordable Care Act and its relationship to Medicare. And the first answer is from Dr. Benishek.
Well, thanks for the question. That's an excellent question. You know, I've been taking care of patients for 30 years in Northern Michigan, and I know how important Medicare is to our, you know, to our elderly. I mean, they depend on it for their medical care. Frankly, the problem with the president's health care bill is it takes $700 billion out of Medicare to pay for the bill. That's $2 billion here in Michigan's 1st District, $200 million right here in Grand Traverse County. So Munson Hospital will be getting $160 million less over the next 10 years to pay for the same patients that are getting Medicare treatment. Hospitals all around my district are cutting back and laying people off. You know, I've visited almost every single hospital in the district, and frankly, they're worried about how they're going to stay open. You know, I mentioned the nursing home earlier. You know, their energy costs are going up while their reimbursement from Medicare is going down. Their health insurance premiums for their employees went up $1 million last year. So with decreasing reimbursement from the government and increasing costs of their health care, they're stuck in the middle. This is the case with a lot of our medical infrastructure. We need to get Medicare under control and make sure that it's funded throughout, make sure that our seniors get the care that they have earned, and make sure we preserve the system for the future.
Thank you. Mr. Bowl.
Yes, I opposed when it happened, and I oppose still today, the Affordable Health Care Act, also known as Obamacare, but not for the reasons that Dan Benishek just described. I'm for another bill called H.R. 676, the single-payer health care system. H.R. 676 would improve patient health, restore free choice of physicians and other clinicians, and assure universal coverage for all people. The problem with the ACA is that it puts the insurance issue in the hands of the marketplace of the insurance industry. And the result is, according to the Congressional Budget Office, that insurance firms are predicted to be handed $901 billion in taxpayer money over the period 2015 to 24 to subsidize their products. That's from the Congressional Budget Office. You'll see a citation to that on my website. Additionally, the issue of universal coverage was brought to the fore in the admission or non-admission of Thomas Eric Duncan to a hospital in Dallas. He did not have insurance. His family thinks that because of that, that's why he was turned away. The hospital denies it, but the hospital has had many contradictions. I think this is a factor to be taken into account. I'll have more to say if there's another question about health care and single payer.
Thank you. General Cannon.
Well, excellent question. And you know, historically, when I was a sheriff, everybody has the idea that insurance and health care was perfect before. It was not. And when I was a sheriff, our insurance premiums were going up 15 to 20% a year. And so the rate of increase on those premiums has slowed because of this legislation that's passed. It really pits people against the insurance company, and that's not the way it should be. The insurance company should not hold people's lives in their hands. And so I think we all agree the good things that have come out of that, sure, there are some issues. Just like any major piece of social legislation that we have ever passed, you don't just throw it out. You got to roll up your sleeves, you got to sit down, and you got to work on it. You got to amend it, reform it, revise it, whatever you got to do. It was a compromise to begin with. If there's things that need to be improved in it, let's get after it. Voting 50-plus times to repeal it is a waste of time. This is a major piece of legislation that addresses a major shortcoming in our national health care system. I sit on a hospital board in Kalkaska. We were struggling. Now we got people coming in doing preventive care, and they have insurance to pay their bills. So it's going good. And I would also say I would be diametrically opposed to any efforts to make Medicare a voucher program. Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is about the role of Congress and the rating of Congress. And I'll try to combine several questions on that topic. One is, Congress has the lowest approval rating in history. What do you see as the problem, and what would you do to fix it? Related to that more locally is, with such a large congressional district to represent, how will you plan to set priorities to know where the district most needs your energies? And we begin with Mr. Bowl.
Jack, that's an impossible question to answer. I'll do my best, but I don't think any of the three of us are going to have a really good answer to that. Congressional deadlock, you know, as a Green, here I am sitting in the middle between a Democrat and a Republican, and so maybe I can be kind of a mediator between them, and maybe if I got into Congress, I would be able to do no reaction. Remember, you're not allowed to respond to anything I say. But Congress's approval rating, there's a lot of bad people to get elected. Some people say if God had meant us to have elections, they would have given us candidates. Well, we're the candidates you got, and you just have to judge us by our ethics and by our demeanor and what we do and what we said last year and what we did last year and 5 years ago and 10 years ago. That's the best answer I can give to that question. As to the size of the district, of course, it's a huge district. I think it's the third biggest geographically. Our predecessor, Bart Stupak, was pretty good about going around the district having town meetings. And I would do the same. I would travel back to the district frequently. So I'll hand it to the next speaker.
Okay, thank you. General Cannon.
Well, it is a shame that things have come to the state that they are today in Congress. It's absolutely a complete disservice to the entire country. We have elected people to go there and represent the people's best interest, and that's not being taken care of. I think the beginnings is to make sure that you get your priorities straight. And so the priority should be the people that asked you and elected you to go to represent their best interest. So, yes, you have two major parties. There's certainly ideologies, but at the end of the day, it has to always be about what is in the best interest of the people of the district. What did you find out? You need to be available and accessible and approachable and aware of what's going on in the district. And you take that. And when you talk about issues, you got to, like, you know, look at every issue that people bring forward. People want to know that they're being listened to. And you take that information and you give it the due consideration it deserves. And so then you look for the facts. There's only one set of facts. And then you ponder the effect on the people in the district, and then you vote accordingly. And so we got to stop the ideology, and we got to start working in the middle. The solution is in the middle. That's where we're going to make progress. Staking out our claims at both extremes is not going to get us anywhere. It's going to leave us exactly where we're at. And so for me, it's all about having the political courage to stand up and tell your caucus that the people in this district are first, And I'm going to vote in their best interest, even if it means crossing party lines. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Benishek.
That's a good question. You know, I ran for Congress when I first ran because I was sick of what was going on in Washington. And the fact of the matter is, it's been very difficult to get things done in Washington, in large part because of the Senate. We've passed 381 pieces of legislation in the House this last session that have not been acted on in the Senate. Right? They haven't come up for a vote. Many of the things that we passed with bipartisan support, 50 or 60 Democrats on some of the bills. And yet the Senate doesn't even bring it up.
Now,
Have a wonderful evening.
Go ahead and
we've done some things. Like, for example, we got a farm bill done. Okay, now we passed a farm bill in the House. Okay, it was a Republican farm bill in the House. The Democrats passed a farm bill in the Senate. It's a Democrat. It's not going to be the same, right? I mean, the Democrat-led Senate is not going to run to do the same thing as the Republican-led House. But then we came together in a conference, and we worked out the differences, and we got it done. We just passed a major VA reform bill. The same thing happened. We passed a bill in the House. They passed their own version in the Senate. We came together in a conference, which I got to be on, and we worked out the differences. We got it done. The problem is that most of the other things that we've passed in the House, the Senate hasn't passed the bill. They haven't done their own part of the bill. You can't negotiate with them if they don't have a position. That's been very frustrating. The thing about being in the district is this. I spent more time crossing this district, talking to people in every corner of the district for the last 3.5 years than I can remember. I spent the fewest days in my home that I could think of. You know, we spend about a week every month traveling the district, and it's been my pleasure to get the people to hear what they have to say. Thanks.
Thank you very much. We have several questions about education, and one relates to what is your position with regard to the Common Core standards? What do you feel is appropriate in terms of helping the development of lower elementary grade children? Should they be taking standardized tests? And further, what could you do at the national level with regard to improving the early childhood education of our children? And the first responder is General Cannon.
Well, excellent question. Now, education is the cornerstone of the greatness of this country. And so we need to make sure that we are supporting our public education in every way, shape, manner, or form possible. And so when we talk about Common Core, my dad was career Navy, drugged me around to about 13 different schools before I graduated. I actually spent the last 5 years at one. And so I can tell you, there is value in having a Common Core. So if you're in the fifth grade in Virginia and you move to Michigan, you're basically about the same. I'd go places, I'd be ahead, and then I'd be behind. It's pretty tough on the kid. And so I see some value in the Common Core, but I would never want to see, you can't believe that one size would fit all. And so you got to really sort of integrate that with what's going on at the local level, in the local school district, and obviously the state's involved in that as well. And so what we're really trying to do with our students is make sure that they are ready and competitive in the world marketplace. And so when you look what's being done in other countries, I mean, there's a lot of great lessons to be learned there about how you go about educating our children. But at the end of the day, our children should all come out of high school prepared to go in any number of directions. If they want to go into business, they want to go on to college, if they want to go into manufacturing, if they want to go into private enterprise, if they want to go into agriculture, they should all be ready to make that decision based on the basic education they got in their local school. Public education is the foundation of the greatness of this country. We need to make sure that we don't let that slide or slip away from us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Dr. Benishek.
Thanks. It's a good question, and it's an issue that I've been working on really for a long time. You know, the federal government has put out these rules that require every school in America to do everything exactly the same. You know, when I went to school, there was no Department of Education, and somehow yet I got an education. You know, right now the curriculum is so limited, there's only 2 hours of elective in the entire four-year term of a high school's time there. And we need to have people be able to have more electives. You know, right now, like vocational education, we've sort of lost that in many of our school districts. You know, vocational education, when I was in school, was an opportunity to get metal shop, auto mechanics, drafting, home ec. There was a lot of opportunity for that. Now we've lost that because of the requirements at the federal level. You know, we need to bring that back to have local school districts have more control over what they're teaching our children to provide for the education that actually leads to a job. The House passed a bill called the Student Success Act, which does exactly that. It gives more money and control back to school districts and states so they can decide more for themselves how to educate their children. The education here in Michigan, in Traverse City, is going to be completely different, perhaps from somebody in Fort Lauderdale. They may need different skills. We need to have our local districts have more control.
Thank you. Mr. Bowl.
In an earlier life, I was a teacher for a year and a half in the late 60s. I taught high school in Chicago. I was at Crane Technical High School the night that the day after Martin Luther King was shot. It was an all-black school, and a riot broke out the next morning. And I was able to get away with a certain amount of trepidation. I ducked out of a side door. I saw chairs being thrown in the hallways, but I was able to get out safely. With that said, I am not going to give a very good answer to the rest of this question because I wasn't a very good teacher, and I moved on. I'm a better lawyer than I am a teacher. So I don't know much about the issues, Common Core, et cetera. I would only ask you to look at at my website and see that I have studied a variety of issues, given thoughtful answers, and if I were elected, I would certainly give attention to the issue of education and give it my best shot, and that's the best I can do. And if there's a question on veterans, that will be my similar answer, because unlike the two of these who do know veterans' issues, I'm not very knowledgeable on that issue.
All right. I have a cluster of three, let's say, hot-button issues, and Dr. Benishek will be the first answer. How do you stand with regard to conceal and carry of guns in the schools and gun control in general? Do you support gay marriage? And what's your position on legalization of marijuana?
That's one question.
Well, let's see now. Legalization of marijuana.
Gun control and conceal and carry.
Gun control.
And gay marriage.
All right. Well, I'm not particularly in favor of the legalization of marijuana. I mean, it's a mind-altering drug. I don't see how that is a good thing for people. I don't know that it's a good thing for young people. I think it's very dangerous for young people to get, you know, using marijuana on a regular basis. I just don't. I don't understand how a drug is good for your mind in general. The same thing could be said for alcohol. So I'm not in favor of legalizing marijuana. Gun control. You know, I firmly believe in the Second Amendment. I believe in the right to bear arms. I don't think that kids should be bringing guns to school. Certainly don't believe that. And gay marriage. I believe that marriage is between one man and one woman. I mean, I respect everyone. I think everybody should have respect and have equal rights. I think there could be a civil union of some sort that would give everyone the same legal rights as everyone else. But frankly, as a Catholic, an institution that's been around for thousands of years has been defined between one man and one woman, and that's what I subscribe to.
Thank you. Mr. Bowl.
Marijuana, I support legalization. Gay marriage, I support. Guns in school, I was, Dan and I were at another debate two or three weeks ago in Gaylord at a high school, and one of the other candidates for one of the other offices running for governor, I think with the Natural Law Party, I'm not sure, was packing heat during the debate. He had it on his hip while he was answering questions about why he should be governor. I was just shocked. So I went home and did some research, come to find out it's legal. I couldn't believe it. And I wrote, the moderator of the debate is, are you sure you want someone with a gun? on the stage at your high school talking to, and I didn't get an answer back. But I don't think guns should be in school. I don't know if there's anything more in the question.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
General Cannon.
Well, I'm not sure I got the order right here, but on the legalization of marijuana, obviously that's an evolving issue. In Michigan, medical marijuana is now legal, and there's and you look in other states, it's even more broader, more broadly available to people than in Washington, I think, in Colorado. So I think in the long run, we're going to have to take a second look at this entire issue of the war on drugs. And so when we go back to there, that's where we start talking about the schedules and where marijuana is going to fit in. It's going to affect a lot of different states in different ways based on what's going on right now. So states are moving in that direction. At the federal level, we need to decide probably, you know, where do we want to be? This war on drugs has been going on for 50 or 60 years. And so it's time to take another look at that. Concealed weapons, I'm all about responsible gun ownership. Guns in schools, you know, that's a bad recipe. That's not a good, and I understand in state law that it is allowed, I get it. But I don't think, I think that needs to have, we need to take another look at that. Because we're creating a situation where you can only imagine the potential things that could go wrong. And so people with the greatest intention in the world, I mean, once we have this mistake, we don't want to be a part of the regrets that are probably going to happen. And on gay marriage, I think I don't discriminate against anybody. I think they should have, you know, those families should have the same legal protections as everybody else. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The first responder for the next question will be Mr. Bowl. It's about federal election campaign finance. And person in the audience writes in that in 2012, $300 million was spent either to elect or defeat candidates. The contributors were never identified. The Disclosure Act was introduced in the Senate this year to bring about more transparency. Would you support more transparency in campaign finance? Do you find that the pressure to raise money for campaigns is a negative influence? And do you support federal election reforms? And the first responder is Mr. Bowl.
Of course, there's too much money in elections. And part of the reason, as everybody knows, is the Citizens United decision of the Supreme Court a few years ago that said corporations are not only persons, but they have free speech rights and they can give money to candidates. So I'm so put off. I'm so appalled by that decision. I do think labor unions should have the rights to give money because a labor union is an aggregation of people. A corporation is an aggregation of property. There's a big difference. Disclosure, of course, there should be maximum disclosure. I don't like websites by bloggers where they don't identify themselves and they can't be held accountable just the same way. I don't like people or corporations or giving money to a candidate or opposing a candidate without identifying themselves. That's my answer.
Thank you. General Cannon.
Well, excellent issue. I think the biggest problem that we have in our political process is the money. And I've come to learn in my efforts here that, you know, a lot of an inordinate amount of time is devoted to raising money, even when you are in office. I'm sure the congressman probably knows this better than I, that you have to spend time raising money. That is just objectionable to me. I think, you know, we would expect our legislators to be there taking care of the people's business, not trying to raise money. But it is what it is. And so to answer the question, I think that we need to have full disclosure. There's no reason that people are donating money to campaigns should not be able to be identified. We want to know where the money is coming from. Big money should have a louder voice than the average person? Absolutely not. So full disclosure, full transparency. Citizens United, bad decision. It's the law of the land, fine. Hopefully we can find another case to kind of reverse that. Does it have a negative impact on the political process? Absolutely. There's absolutely no way that your voice as the people should ever be drowned out because somebody has more money. Money is not, you know, money, people need to have their voice heard just as loudly as those people, those few people that have large amounts of money at their disposal. And finally, yes, I think, you know, when you look in Europe, elections take, like, I don't even know. Everywhere is a little different. 90 days, set amount of money, that's it. It's over with. These things go on for 16. I've been involved in this for 16 months. So, yeah, I'm all about election reform as well. Thank you.
Dr. Benishek.
Well, I believe in free speech and that you should be able to support a candidate that you like. Right now, corporations are not allowed to give to candidates. I haven't received a penny from a corporation, and neither has General Cannon or Mr. Bull, because it's against the law for corporations to donate to campaigns. It always has been. Every single person that has donated to me who has given over $50, you can look it up and see who has given to me. So, I mean, if you give to a campaign, you have to submit who you work for, what your name is, where you live. So as far as giving to campaigns, you can find out who gave to me just by looking it up at the FEC. So as far as outside groups, they can spend money, but they can't talk to me, okay? Or they can't talk to Mr. Cannon. They can spend money in your race, but they can't really talk about one person or the other. They talk about issues for the most part. That's something completely different than donating to campaigns. I mean, I had to learn this too. I mean, when I ran for Congress, I didn't know a thing about it. But I learned that, if somebody gives to you, we have to write it and report it to the FEC. So that happens all the time. So the fact that people are giving anybody's campaign money without anybody being having access to it, that's just wrong.
Thank you. The next question, our first response will come from General Cannon, and it has to do with immigration. What is your position with regard to reform of immigration, with regard to amnesty for persons currently in the United States without legal status, and should there be a guest worker's path to citizenship?
Well, I think we're long overdue for immigration reform, comprehensive immigration reform. If you talk with the agricultural community, it's important that they have a program in place that's going to enable them to have the staff that they need to kind of work in their fields and do the work that many other people won't do. And so immigration reform is a pretty broad issue. If it means putting more troops on the border to move the issue forward, to keep putting this off and not addressing it is a great disservice to those people and to the people, to the country as a whole. If a child was brought to this country by their parents under the DREAM Act, I think they should, through no fault of their own, they should have the ability to, and many of them join the military, for example, and serve their country in a lot of different ways. And so they should have the opportunity to become a citizen. And so for me, when we talk about amnesty, I think everybody that's here illegally, whatever the number is, 10 to 15 million, get back in line and go through the process just like everybody else did. I'm second generation Irish in this country. My family went through the right process. I think everybody else should as well. So I don't think there should be a blanket amnesty, but let's get them out of the shadows, get them in line, let's start the process, and let's get this done. They will do like every other immigrant group did to our country, make us better and stronger. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Benishek.
Well, there's three parts of the immigration problem from what people are in the district are telling me. Number one, people in the district are telling me they want to see the border secured. Number one, that we've got thousands of people coming across the border every year. We don't know who they are. We don't know where they're going and what they're doing. That has to stop, and we need to get our border under control. We're like the only country in the world that doesn't control their border. And we need to reform the way people come here legally. I mean, it's actually very difficult to move into this country legally. We need to make that easier for the people that we need to work here. The other thing that we need to deal with is our agricultural workers. I mean, I'm talking to farmers all across the district, and they tell me that the way that agricultural workers come and go, it just does not work. It's not good for them. There's crops left in the field. This fall, the apples haven't been picked because they can't get the workers. We need to have a guest worker program that allows people experts really in fruit harvesting, to come and work here on a temporary basis and be able to go back to Mexico and come back and have some sort of a card that allows them to do that. I mean, it doesn't make any sense that that doesn't occur today. And then the real problem is the people of what to do with the people that are here right now, the 15 million people that are here. And there's a lot of controversy over that. You know, some people want to ship them all back. Some people think they should have blanket amnesty. You know, we tried some things back in the ages that didn't work. And frankly, we need to have a public discussion about what that plan should be.
Thank you. Mr. Bowles.
Thanks.
Immigration. I wrote a legal rights book for Teamsters in 1984 when I was practicing labor law, and I looked back at that the other day. And I said then, and I still believe today, that people should be allowed to cross into the United States from Canada or Mexico the same way that people cross into Michigan from Ohio. I don't believe immigration. I don't think there should be any different immigration laws nationally from what we have for the states. There's an issue that's been raised, though. What about criminal people who might come from other countries? I think those issues should be dealt with through the criminal laws. Unlike my two opponents here, I cannot say, however, that I am or my family is of recent immigration. My family goes back way long before that. But in general, my position is for free passage.
Thank you very much. The first response to the next question will be Dr. Benishek. Regarding the Ebola crisis, how would you balance current demands to ban direct flights from Africa against analysis that this would make the situation worse? And what would you do to deal with this Ebola situation? Dr. Benishek.
Well, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever that we haven't stopped the flights already. Okay, because the first thing you have when you have an infectious disease outbreak, you make sure that it stays quarantined. I mean, the CDC has really fallen down here. We're not doing that well against Ebola. We've had one patient come with Ebola. We got two nurses who are really sick. Okay, we need to contain the disease in Africa. You know, and they have inconsistent rules. I mean, the nurse in Texas was told she shouldn't get on a plane. Well, so why are we telling people in Liberia to get on planes and come here? How does that make any sense? The CDC, told people who've been in contact with people with disease not to fly. And yet they told people on the airplane, well, don't worry, you're not going to get the disease. How does that make any sense? You know, I think the American people would be much more comfortable if there was a uniform plan and we contain the disease in Africa. I'm a doctor. I understand infectious disease. I've talked to infectious disease specialists. They simply don't understand what the CDC is doing here by allowing these flights to continue. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bowles.
The most important thing that Dan Benishek said just now is that we need to contain the disease in Africa. There's been only three patients in the United States, at least that I've heard, that have got it. But in Africa, it's a big, big problem. And surprisingly, the most intelligent, forward-thinking, humanitarian country that's acting on this is Cuba. This is from the New York Times of a few days ago. Cuba has medical professionals in the field in Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea, where the greatest outbreak is. Cuban health care workers will be among the most exposed foreigners, and yet they're going anywhere. Most insurance companies will not fly Ebola patients, but these Cuban health care workers and doctors are going there anyway. I'm reading from the New York Times editorial the other day. The work of these Cuban medics benefit the entire global effort, and they should be recognized for that. Cuban doctors assume the lead role in treating cholera after Haiti's earthquake in 2010. The first group of 165 professionals arrived in Sierra Leone in recent days from Cuba. Why hasn't there been an influx of American doctors to Africa? This is where the problem is. This is where it needs to be solved.
Thank you. General Kennan.
Well, it would be nice if we could reach around the world and have everybody do everything the exact same way. That's probably going to be a challenge. Maybe the UN can take that up. I don't know. But I'm against the having the travel ban for a variety of reasons. First of all, it's not going to work, and what we don't want to have happen is that people who are possibly infected or have been exposed go underground and find a workaround way to travel to another country that's not on some restricted list and then come in. Then we would not know about them at all. Right now, when the flights are coming out of that part of Western Africa, we got people there. We know the airline. We're checking them for fever. We know that. We don't want people to go into hiding and trying to come to the country in a lot of different ways. And so the worst thing we could do is try to politicize this process and try to make it bigger than it is. They'll probably, according to what I've read, and I don't have any of the insights that maybe a member of Congress has, but there'll probably be more people die of the flu this year than of Ebola if this all goes according to plan. I will listen to the experts, okay? What they say, I trust them. And so when we make when we buy the acceptable risk, when we make these acceptable, when we make these dramatic cuts to our Center of Disease Control and the National Institute of Health, these things can be expected. Tremendous cuts have now made us vulnerable in controlling this this problem in our country.
Thank you. Mr. Bull, you'll get a chance to answer first this next question, which is, would you support a minimum wage of $10 an hour? And if not, what do you consider a minimum living wage? Mr. Bull.
$10 an hour seems kind of low. I would support at least that. But the main way that the working class, and I use the word working class, not middle class, is going to make advances in this country is through organization of the class. I don't think it can be handed down from on high by a government. I think workers need to self-organize, and they do that through labor organizations called unions. So the most important way that gains can be made and be solidified would be through strengthening organizations of workers in their workplaces without interference or possibility of discharge or retaliation by employers.
Thank you. General Cannon.
I didn't hear the last part of that question. I get the minimum wage.
Okay. Would you support a minimum wage, or what would you consider to be a living minimum wage?
Okay. Well, first of all, I'm all about creating an environment where we can have young people make, what we need to find is a way to create sustainable year-round jobs with a living wage. And so I would support $10 an hour. $10 an hour is just going to get you out of poverty. It's going to get you just out of poverty. A living wage would probably, if the minimum wage would have kept up with inflation, it'd be like $17 an hour. $10 an hour is only $20,000 a year. $20,000 a year, if you're a single mom with a couple of kids, I don't know how you do it. I absolutely don't know how you do it. And so the fastest growing industry or business in every community, in my experience, is going around the district, is the food pantry. So we need to figure out a way to get people to a point where they can make a sustainable living wage, where they can support their family. And so is $10 an hour the answer? No. Michigan just passed some legislation where it's going to be something less than that. The idea of 10-10 is to get folks out of poverty. Maybe that'll have an effect, depending on the size of their family, on some of the social programs they might be eligible for. But for me, if that's the starting point, if we got a crawl, walk, run, if $10 is the number, okay, let's go there. But that's not the end of the story. That's not the be-all, end-all. We need to continue to build on that.
Thank you. Dr. Benishek.
That's a good question. Frankly, I don't want to see anybody trying to live on the minimum wage. What we need in this country is some wages that you can raise a family and buy a home. I think of the minimum wage, frankly, as a stepping stone for young people to get into the job market. I mean, if a young person getting their first job and never had a job before, that's the place for the minimum wage to get the person the skill and the training and the discipline to be able to do a good job and learn the skills to get them a better job.
And that's where the living wage comes in. And to tell you the truth, that's the problem we have in this country, is that this economy, it's very hard to find jobs that you can raise a family on. The people that I've talked to in small business saying that if we increase the wage, there are going to be fewer jobs out there. Well, I want to see more jobs that you can actually raise a family. That's why we've been working on cutting back the regulation that's coming out of Washington that's killing jobs in northern Michigan. And that's why I'm working on vocational education to improve the education ability to get an education, you can actually find a job. I mean, there's 75,000 jobs in the state of Michigan that are unfilled because the people don't have the right skills. Certified nursing assistants, welders, computerized manufacturing. And these don't need a four-year college degree. You can get a six-week certificate. You can get a one-year certificate. You can get a two-year associate degree that can lead to a good-paying job. And we need to get the opportunity to get that education to the people that need it.
Thank you. General Cannon, you'll be up first on this one. With respect to Native Americans, how do you feel about the federal government's role and responsibility in meeting the health care and education needs of the Native Americans who live in our district?
Well, I support all of the I've met with the Native American tribes in our district. There's 12 tribes in Michigan. And I've met with eight. They are an integral part of the makeup of this district. The economic impact that they have is phenomenal. I'm not sure I understood the question. You're talking about their health care.
What could the federal government do more to support health care and education?
Well, I tell you, probably the biggest thing. And they are they do a phenomenal job. The things that they do in their communities actually take the pressure off the greater community, the county, for example. But where we're really hurting not only the tribal nations but everybody is with the sequestration and what's been done with the budget, where you can't make good, logical budget choices. Everything is cut across the board. And so I think financially, I think the tribal nations are working through this. The biggest obstacle for them is that the cuts that are made through sequestration have had a dramatic impact on their ability to make good, smart choices in how they're going to provide for the services of the people of their community. Thank you.
Dr. Benishek.
Well, I'm proud to say that I've been able to serve on the Indian Affairs Subcommittee of the Committee on Natural Resources since I've been in Congress. We have eight tribes in the district, and been in communication with most of them and been very helpful with their issues. I think really what we need to be sure of is that we maintain the tribal sovereignty so that they can do what they want with their land. And that will give them the freedom to do more and make it, you know, have their own destiny. The programs that the federal government oversees for the Indians, the Indian Bureau of Indian Affairs is like a disaster working with them. It's really a mess. You know, our office has been working with that to try to improve the health care funding. There's so many. It's just that these Bureau of Indian Affairs people think it's like giving the Indian a blanket and a mule is like the thing to do. I mean, it's just horrible the way they treat the tribes. And we've been working to improve that since I've been there. I think the key is tribal sovereignty so that they have the ability to do what they want with their land and then be able to, have their own government and their own solutions.
Thank you. Mr. Bowl.
Well, my contact with Native Americans is that a Native American married Lou Ann and me 2 years ago. I have several friends. I've represented several tribal members in the Little Traverse Bay bands of Odawa Indians, including in the tribal court. I had three cases in the tribal court. But coming to the question, I agree with Dan about sovereignty. It's very important to recognize the importance of Native sovereignty. But I am troubled by one thing Dan mentioned, not about Dan himself, but about the setup. He said that he's on the Native American Subcommittee of Natural Resources. Wait a second. Natural resources are forests and animals and wildlife and trees and air. Native Americans are people. Why are they part of natural resources? I don't get it. He needs a change there.
Thank you. The first responder on the next question will be Dr. Benishek. Regarding voting rights, the Senate has held a hearing on Voting Rights Amendment Act of 2014, H.R. 3899. The Act ensures that every eligible voter is treated fairly at the ballot box and has an equal right and equal access to vote. Do you support holding hearings in the House Judiciary Committee on this issue?
Who's first? Who's next?
I'm sorry. Did you answer the last question, Jerry?
Dr. Benishek, you're next.
Okay.
Yeah.
Could you repeat the
question?
Yeah, certainly. I'm sorry.
The Senate has held a hearing on the Voting Rights Amendment of 2014, and the Act ensures that every eligible voter is treated fairly at the ballot box and has an equal right and equal access to vote. Do you support hearings on this issue in the House Judiciary Committee?
I'm not familiar with the amendment. The Senate voted on an amendment?
Let me change the question to a different aspect of the same issue, or related issue. What changes, if any, would you make to the Voting Rights Act to ensure that all may vote, including those who are homeless? Is that?
Well, I want to be sure that everybody can vote, absolutely. Okay. I don't understand the question, I guess, other than that, I think that you should be able to identify yourself and, maybe have an ID so that would make sure that people aren't voting more than once. I think that's the key issue. And as long as you're registered to vote and have an ID, I think you should be able to vote.
Okay. Mr. Bowles.
I too, find the question confusing, but I understand the question to be asking, what do I think about voter ID and election fraud? And I don't believe that election fraud is a major issue. It's not something I've studied in depth, but my impression is that the attempts, I've heard of many attempts in recent years to require voter ID, to roll back on people registering and voting the same day. I don't agree with that. I believe our election law should be inclusive and people should be brought in. More people should be brought in to vote. We have such low participation in voting in the United States compared to other countries, and the solution to that is to find more inclusive ways to bring more and more people to the polls. I do think, though, I'm not particularly in favor of early voting. I know everybody else is in favor of it, but I'm not. I think there's a benefit to people coming to a polling booth on election day physically and mingling with the other people and being part of a common electorate, and because I think that raises the sense of community, and I think community is so important. It's one of the reasons I support labor organizations. So I'm just throwing that in.
Thank you, General Cannon.
Well, to answer the question directly, I would support the House. It's easy for me to say this, to have those hearings. If the Senate has passed something to ensure that people have equal rights and access to voting, so I would support that. Any effort to suppress the vote is just unconscionable to me. And so I got to tell you, when I served overseas in Iraq, we worked to get them the right to vote. People would walk 50 to 100 miles to come and vote. And when they would cast their ballot, they'd put their fingerprint on the ballot, and they'd have their little, purple finger with the ink on it. I mean, that was a badge of honor and pride, and it's something that they had waited for a long, long time. It's a sin and a shame that today, in the best of elections, we get maybe 50% of the people out to vote. Okay, so unacceptable. We got to do a better job on our own to improve that, to get people excited and interested to be a part of this process. But any effort to suppress the vote through a poll tax, we're not doing that anymore, but any kind of constriction of the ability for people to vote is something that I would not stand for. I don't believe there's any widespread election fraud. There's no reason to do these things other than to try to suppress the vote. And that's a non-starter with me. And so we just need to make sure that this is such a precious right that we don't ever do anything to kind of devalue that. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bowl, you're first on the next question, which is foreign policy related. Should the U.S. send troops to Syria and or Iraq to fight the Islamic State?
The short answer is no. And just a moment, I'll give you the long answer. Well, I've been involved in anti-war efforts for many, many years. I helped to organize about 8 or 10 demonstrations against the Iraq War in 02 and 03 and 04. It was wrong for the U.S. to go in there. It was on a ruse of weapons of mass destruction. Well, those weapons didn't exist. I advocated at the time that we should pull out right away, and I'm still advocating for that now. The greater danger is not ISIS. The greater danger is the government in Syria. And yet the U.S. is putting all its eggs in the wrong basket. And the forces that the U.S. is supporting, I think it's called the Free Syria Army. This is all on my website, by the way. There's an ISIS page on my website. These are our guys. They do beheadings, too. There's an example of 6 beheadings by the Free Syria Army of ISIS people. So why are we supporting them, and yet the United States is? So the short answer is we should get out. It's not our business. The Kurds are the best forward, thinking people and acting people there.
General Cannon.
Well, first of all, this is a very complex part of the world, obviously. My position has always been that we need to exhaust all diplomatic options first. A lot of things will always be happening beneath the surface. Obviously, if you're dealing with ISIS, how are you going to do diplomacy with them? You don't. But you work with the neighboring countries that are in the region. They need to want this as much or more than we do. We can't do it for them. And so once we get them to, when you talk about putting boots on the ground, especially in Iraq, and I got to tell you, with the new prime minister, they don't want us. They don't want combat troops on the ground. We've got about 1,500 troops in Iraq now just doing advising and mentoring and trying to rebuild. Complicated issue, without a doubt. And we need to build that coalition in the region and have them be the ones to take on the fight with ISIS or ISIL or IS, whatever you want to call them. And then we can play a great role. We can play a role logistically and with training and with resources. But I think if we put boots on the ground, we're going to own that. This is an ideological issue, and if we become the focus of all that attention, this is just going to spread. And as ISIL leaves the area, it's going to just crop up somewhere else. So it'll be like whack-a-mole. We don't need to be putting boots on the ground in either of those countries. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Benishek.
What we need is a disciplined, consistent foreign policy. We haven't had any leadership from this administration. The president has been telling us for the last 6 years that the war on terror is over with and that we need to pull out of that whole area. Well, all of a sudden, within a few weeks, the plan has completely changed. ISIS is a real threat. We're going to be fighting this war for years. What's going on here? I don't understand that flip-flop decision-making process. Now, the president did come to Congress and ask us to support a training Syrian rebels on the ground, and we did that until December 10th. We allowed him to train those people on the ground. Frankly, I don't want to send our men and women on the ground over there without a clear plan of action. I mean, I'm a father. My daughter served in Iraq and Afghanistan for 5 years. I've taken care of veterans for over 20 years. I've seen the injuries caused by wars overseas. And frankly, the president hasn't come to us with any sort of a plan. I mean, he hasn't told us, this is our plan, this is our long-term strategy, this is our exit policy, this is what victory is going to look like. We haven't seen any of that. The president hasn't said a word about anything like that. So I would not vote. I mean, frankly, I would not vote to allow our men and women in harm's way until we have a better plan of action.
Thank you. General Cannon, you will be first, which may well be our last question, and that is, What would you do to solve the problem of income inequality, particularly with regard to taxes, and if you would address also the issue of equal pay for women, the Lilly Ledbetter Act? Income inequality, taxation, and equal pay for women. General Cannon.
Well, first of all, I'm a strong advocate for equal opportunity and equal pay for equal work. And so it's been very easy in my professional life to make sure that that happens, obviously working for the government. And it's easy, and it does work. No harm, no foul. The problem is when you get away from that kind of a regimented situation, it's private enterprise. And so for me, I think everybody, if you're doing the job, and I've read a couple of interesting stories and situations where somebody who trained all the people that worked in a particular factory and overseen them and supervised them, and then when the company went out of business, they found out she was the last person there, and so she's going through the file. Everybody that she trained and supervised made more money than her. Absolutely wrong. Not right. That's just not the American way. And so I think income inequality is an issue that certainly deserves to be placed high on an agenda that needs to be addressed, and it needs to be resolved in a manner that everybody is comfortable with. And so it's easy, you know, when you talk about equal pay for equal work, but when you talk about that income disparity between professionals, for example, you know, we got to really get into the heart and the conscience of our private enterprise and make them want to do the right things for the right reasons. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Dr. Benishek.
Well, I absolutely believe in equal pay for equal work. And I acknowledge the fact that there are cases in this country where that discrimination still exists, and we need to work to end that. Frankly, I'm against discrimination of any sort. Now, we need to solve that problem. We need to solve the problem of women and men not having opportunity to find a good-paying job. That's the real problem in this country, is that people are not getting raises, they're not getting bonuses, they're simply happy to have a job. Women and men are having difficulty finding good-paying jobs. They should be equal, but we need to get this economy moving so that everyone's being able to raise a family and buy a home. And the policies of this administration, the EPA run amok has been killing jobs in northern Michigan. We need to get the EPA off our back, and we need to focus on vocational education to get the training that will lead to a good-paying job. So I'm all for doing all that. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Mr. Bowl.
The primary economic problem in the United States today is income inequality. So I do appreciate the question. All of the studies that I've been looking at lately emphasize how the 1% versus the 99% the divide is getting worse and worse and worse. When the first question of this debate, we were asked about taxation policy, and I outlined a number of progressive taxation policies that I recommended, including taxes on financial transactions and other items. But the most important way, as I alluded to in an earlier question, that the working class is really going to step forward in this country is through organization of the class itself, through at the workplace. And so anything that could be done in that regard, and that involves people themselves, not the government. As to sex discrimination, I've brought sex discrimination cases. I've fought for that in my law practice and race discrimination cases as well. So certainly this is an issue that I've given a lot of thought to over the years.
Thank you. General Cannon. Oh, sorry. He's already done. We have many, many questions that we will not have time to pose. We will start with the closing remarks in just a moment, but the topics are very impressive: student debt, PAC money in politics, abortion, defense spending, Social Security, fracking, single-payer health care, foreign aid, role of the federal government, the VA healthcare system, Cuba, and most, last but not least, the state of Michigan's roads. Unfortunately, in order to meet our timeline of 8:30, we will not have time to get to all of these questions, which are terrific, but the candidates will have a chance to answer them on their websites or through their public statements. We will begin our closing remarks with Major General Cannon.
Well, again, I'd like to thank the League for sponsoring tonight's event. Phenomenal opportunity, and I appreciate having the conversation. As I said before, Congress is broken. And unless we demand it, nothing is going to change. Congressman Benishek has had 4 years to do something about it, but he hasn't. And when staying in Congress becomes a priority, the people's best interest suffers. We cannot wait another 2 years. It's time for a change. By now, I would expect my congressman to have embraced the level of constituent service of his predecessor and to have a close working relationship with our state and local leaders. I would look for legislation that was authored and sponsored or passed, or important committee work that would have helped veterans, not hurt them. I would want a leader in the fight for unemployment benefits last Christmas, or the Great Lakes Restoration, or the Essential Air Service, or our Postal Service, or our electric rates, or anything that would have directly benefited the people of our district. If not a leader, I would want my congressman to be a fighter against the worst absurdity of all, which is sequestration and the shutting down of our government, or the efforts to privatize Social Security or turning Medicare into a voucher system. The list goes on and on. What's happening? I'm not a doctor, but for me, this is a prescription for failure. What's missing, in my 2 cents, is that we're lacking leadership and political courage. We need a congressman who isn't looking to stay in Washington, but is a humble public servant to the great people of this district. Leadership is going against the grain. It's standing tall. It's leaning in. It's having the grit to tell your caucus that the people of the district have to come first. It's crossing party lines if necessary to get things done. It's being keenly aware of an impending adversity and doing something to prevent it. This is Michigan's first congressional district. We need to have a first-class effort to make sure that we're getting a fair shake. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Benishek.
I'd like, to thank the League of Women Voters for hosting us tonight, and thank General Cannon and Mr. Bull for their participation. You know, as a doctor, I treated patients and veterans for over 30 years in Northern Michigan, working to help people and find solutions to their medical problems. When I ran for Congress, it was because I was concerned that our children and grandchildren would not have the same opportunity to earn the American dream that we had growing up, because the debt being left to them is the result of out-of-control spending in Washington. We can no longer afford trillion-dollar failed stimulus bills, a health care law that's increasing costs while reducing options, and the bureaucratic red tape of Barack Obama and Nancy Pelosi that is hurting our economy and costing us jobs. Having the opportunity to represent Northern Michigan families in Congress is a privilege. I have been able to travel all around our great, great district, meeting and learning about the issues that impact families, seniors, employers, and employees. Working together, we've made some progress. I'm proud that together we got legislation to protect the Sleeping Bear Dunes enacted into law. We're building opportunities for vocational education so people can get a family-supporting, home-buying job. We have taken on the bureaucrats at the VA who have been denying care to our veterans, some of which I saw firsthand while treating veterans at the VAs up here. And while we have begun to fix the broken health care law that is hurting families, hurting small business, hurting seniors, and hurting Medicare, we cannot afford to go back to the policies of Nancy Pelosi and Barack Obama that my opponent supports. More spending, more red tape, Obamacare, and higher taxes are not the answer. I thank you for the opportunity to be here tonight and ask for your vote on November 4th. Thank you, and may God continue to bless the United States of America.
Thank you. Mr. Bowen.
I to thank the league. I'm going to do something unusual because a question did not come on the issue of Guantanamo Bay, and I'm going to yield the remainder of my time to General Cannon to answer four specific questions which are on my website. Here they are. What precipitated the early 2004 order that 48 prisoners surrender their pants even during prayer? What conversation?
I'm sorry, Mr. Paul, this is the time for final statements. Would you kindly make your final statement? Thank you.
Okay, well, then I just recommend that everyone look at my website and look at the Guantanamo page on that issue, and I recommend that Major General Cannon answer those questions in a public forum very soon. In further summary, abortion we didn't get to, but I support women's right to choose. Again, climate change is my major issue. I will do anything to stop climate change and stop greenhouse gas emissions. The greenhouse ice, the Greenland ice sheet is in danger of slipping into the ocean and raising the level of the seas by 23 feet, according to report from the UN, and this is far and away the most important issue of our times. So if you elect me to Congress, this will be my priority.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, we should extend our thanks also to all the League members who've worked so hard to make this forum successful, and thanks to you for showing the interest and being here. And please join me in thanking these three candidates for their outstanding participation.